Dear audience, the Doors colleagues, and all interested in teacher selections, and our guest of honor, Professor Janet Clinton, very warm welcome. My name is Anna-Maja Poikkeus, and I'm the Dean of the Faculty of Education and Psychology, and on behalf of the faculty, I'm very, very delighted to welcome you all to this exciting and important event. We are honored to have you here at the university. This was founded in 1863 as the first Finnish language teacher seminary, and is now, we think, internationally acknowledged university with six faculties. And one of the fields that this university emphasizes is learning, teaching, and learning and growth environment. So it's very appropriate and timely that we're gathering here. You're also very warmly welcome to the facilities of Ruusupuisto, the Rose Garden. We have been sort of living in this building for about 3 years. It houses three larger units, the Faculty of Education and Psychology, especially the staff of Educational Sciences, the Open University of the University, and the Finnish Institute of Educational Research. The facilities of our Department of Psychology are sort of on the other side of the railway by the lake, and they house their psychophysiological labs and EEG and MEG there. But we, of course, work closely together, and it's a short distance. In this building, we have two departments, the Department of Education, offering BA and MA degrees in early childhood education, special education, education, adult education, and educational leadership. And the other department is teacher education, offering MA degrees for primary school teachers, pedagogical studies for secondary school teachers, and guidance and counseling degrees and study modules. We are very closely affiliated with the teacher training school over on that side. Two buildings with teaching staff of 90 and serving more than 700 basic education students and about 300 upper secondary school students. So we have a teacher training school very close by for our practicing teacher students. The university and our faculty has been very keenly involved in curriculum development and also in student selections research already for many, many years. And we are very proud to host this event, which clearly shows a very strong initiative, a unity, and joining of expertise of all universities in Finland and all units providing teacher education. I think we have come quite a long way, even in this short time that we have spent together in meetings, Skype meetings, in Turku, in various places. I think that we have shown that these are quite challenging tasks that we have taken to sort of unify and renew our selection process. But I think we have learned the way to negotiate and to sort of find compromises and find best ways to address the questions, which sometimes can be hard. So comparing to some other fields, I think that we are much further than maybe some others in the process of upcoming changes. So I'm sure that we will follow that same kind of strong sharing spirit today in our meeting. And we thought about having a very short sort of introduction just to show like who we are. So if it's okay with you, could you sort of just please state your name and from which university or unit you're from? Okay, thank you so much. From Lapland to Helsinki, to Turku, a lot of people from Rauma. It's a nice collection of representation. And I'll give to Anu.
So, thank you, Anna-Maja Riitta-Leena, for having us here. It's really great to be here. And perhaps some of you don't know yet who we are. So, I'm Anu Varinovski, the project leader of this DOORS OVET project. And I also work in the University of Turku as a manager of faculty affairs. And you are?
I am Mirva Heikkilä, the project manager of this DOORS project. Nice to meet you all.
Okay, then some words about the project itself, because perhaps the first one, I think we'll start with that, because it's a beautiful picture, and it's jointly made. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Practice is important. So, we started in our projects in August. We had a meeting in Turku, and there were pretty many of you then present in Turku, and it was a great pleasure to start the project. We were really excited, and we were motivated, but a little bit also frightened. What should we do? Okay, we have a project, and we have a budget over 1 million, and we have a huge task to do. And since that, a lot has been done. I'm really proud of the project people all over the Finland, because we have been really active, and we have been really active together. And already now, since it has been a little bit over a half a year since we started, we have gained a lot. But of course, we still have a lot to do. And about this picture, as you can see, there is quite perhaps familiar doors for you. So I think this picture is pretty much about our project. That, okay, there are similarities, like we do have doors in our buildings, but still the doors are different. But we are doing this project together. And the other one, it's really research based. Okay, then some words. What have we done already? So this is something that, okay, we are already in objectives. Our manager is really quick, even quicker than the the leader. Okay, so you know the background for this, but perhaps Janet doesn't know, so some word about that. So we have gained this amount, 1.3 million euros from the Ministry of Education and Culture. And as we all know that nowadays there is also some 12 million euros coming from the Ministry again. So this project we started in 2017, and this will end until 2020. And the coordinator is University of Turku. And then about our objectives. So the research based is really important in our project, and we are doing the development of the selection process for teacher education, and especially we are interested in the suitability phase of this selection. We don't mess with the vakava phase. It's already done and really, really good and well, but it's about the suitability. The situation has been previously that all our teacher education units have had separate selection methods for this suitability phase, and that's something that we have found that it's not good. It's not good for the applicant, but it's not good for our units neither. And what is important that we are doing this together as a national cooperation. Okay, and then about us. So here are pretty much people from the University of Turku and also University of Helsinki, of Eastern Finland, of here, University of Jyväskylä, University of Lapland, University of Oulu, University of Tampere, and Åbo Akademi University. Was someone from Åbo Akademi? I didn't hear that. Okay, well, that's a pity, but they have been working with us here. And we have several student organizations. At first, it was our local organizations, but then it's also Seoul working with us And we have been doing this with City of Turku also. Okay, and then about our sub-projects. We do have three different sub-projects. And the first one, you will hear more about this after we have had some coffee. Riitta-Leena and Anna-Maja will talk about. But just mainly that it's about building a teacher's competence model. And we really need that model for the selection phase, but not only to the selection phase, but we see expertise of teachers as a continuum. It starts before the selection, and the selection phase is important, but of course really important is the initial teacher education phase and also orientation phase when the new teachers are starting their careers, and also the further or continuing education for teachers. So this is a really a broad theoretical base that we are doing here. And what is really, what has been really delighted is that people in Jyväskylä, they have been really active in this, and the model is in pretty good shape already, although we haven't worked so long time in it. Okay, and then the sub-project number two. This is perhaps the main thing for the selection process. So we have 10 models. In this phase, those are different models, but our goal is to combine those. And in 2019, we will be developing those models together in small groups. And those groups are University of Turku with University of Jyväskylä, and then University of Helsinki with University of Eastern Finland, and then University of Lapland and University of Oulu together with University of Tampere. Did I mention everything? Okay, great. And when we applied for the money, we said that our goal is to have a proposal for a national model for the selection phase. And we have been discussing about that. Perhaps it won't be a proposal. Perhaps it will be a model in 2020. But this is still in progress. Okay, and then sub-projects number three, and you will also hear about this project more. It's coordinated by University of Turku, and Mirja-Maija Mikkilä-Erdman is the head of this sub-project, and you will be hearing more about this. And this is kind of a loop of feedback from our empirical studies to the model the sub-project number one. Okay. So that was that, and our goal is now in 2020, but still it will be more uniform then. But will it be uniform in a national level? We don't know that yet, but we are in a progress. And what I would like to remind you about this year, 2020, if we select our students or applicants in 2020, they will be in a teaching profession until 2060. And those who they have been taught during their career, they will be in working life since 2110 or something. So we really have a straight link to the future. And that we have to keep in mind.
And for further information, you can go to our website, and there is not so much happening there yet, but when the project goes on and progresses, more information will be added. And we are also on social media, on Facebook. You can go and like us and follow us, and we are also on Twitter. And I have made some hashtags for today. This is the official hashtag of the project, and here a hashtag of this event. And I would also like to welcome you who are listening this live streamed version of this event.
Okay, and those of you who are in our project and you have recognized that some of the people have nice t-shirts and you don't have, don't worry, you will get one during this day or night. And you can always contact Saga for these t-shirt issues if you would like to have immediately one. So please, Saga will help you. But now, okay, so our keynote speaker is Professor Janet Clinton from the University of Melbourne. Professor Janet Clinton is the director of the Center for Program Evaluation and director of the International Teacher Education Effectiveness Research Hub at the Melbourne Graduate School of Education. She has wide national and international experience as an evaluator, psychologist, and educator, and has an extensive publication record. She teaches a number of postgraduate subjects in the discipline of evaluation in the areas of quantitative and mixed methodologies, and she supervises a number of PhD students in the area of evaluation. Professor Clinton has worked in Australia, New Zealand, and the USA, and has been a principal investigator on many large complex evaluations and research projects. Recently, she was the principal evaluator for the Australian Professional Standards for Teaching and the real-time captioning pilot in Victorian schools. She currently leads the Visible Classroom Initiative as well as directs the Teacher Capability Assessment Tool project. So please, whenever you are ready.
Just miking up.
Okay.
I gather now you're all energized and you're ready to talk about selection of teachers or selection of pre-service teachers. I will try and come at this from a more global perspective. Spending time with our colleagues yesterday, I think I was very clear in the view that I think the world of teacher education, or what is happening with pre-service teaching or pre-service teacher education, is a global phenomenon. What is happening in Finland is happening in Australia, all at different levels, and I understand the context, but I do believe that reform for teacher education is a global issue. And many of the things that have been happening to you that happened to us. So I am hoping that what I can share with you today about the way we are programs will not only be of interest to you, but we'll be able to share. And I'm hoping to learn from you what's happening here in your various institutions, and get some feedback as well about what we're doing. Sharing for us, I think, is going to be really important. When people ask me to talk about selection of candidates into teacher education, my response is often, are you crazy? It is such a sensitive issue. When I talk to many of our teacher educators, to many of our pre-service teachers, to our school principals, to our dean, our recent dean, who said to me, why are we bothering with all of this? Why don't we just take anybody who comes? If we are free, inclusive, and want to give everybody a chance, then why bother? It's a big question, and sadly, I often say, well, I think selection is about understanding who wants to be a teacher and what an image of effective teaching actually is. And so I understand that there are people that may not be suited to teaching. But I also understand that there are people given the right program, the right course, they will make fabulous teachers, even in the beginning, if they don't look like you imagine a good teacher is going to look like. And that may be one of our issues. In education, in our schools, one of the prime understandings of effective teaching that you as a teacher will know your student. You will know who you are teaching. That's not the case in teacher education. We often don't know who we are, who they are, and what they need. And that kind of seems strange. So, as I said, I don't have the answer to the why, but I do firmly believe that if we know who we are teaching, then our teachers will actually be more effective. So when we ask this question, why, I go, well, okay, let's think about it. Let's go to the beginning, because it's a very nice place to start, and I promise I will not sing. It has been done, and it didn't go down well, so I won't do it. But I think the view, particularly the view at the University of Melbourne, has been that if we need to understand effective teaching, then let's track all the way back to how we are actually selecting people on this journey. And if we start there, which kind of is selection, then maybe we'll understand what the idea of creating a professional really is. The University of Melbourne, we have had no choice. We have been told by our federal government that we must have a sophisticated and transparent method of selection to ensure equity, diversity, and that we are giving everybody a chance. So the pathway, we would argue, to effective teachers is asking our teachers right from the beginning of their education journey to be reflective and consider who they are and what they need to be effective. In Australia, it means that our teachers need to have an effective training system, an effective teacher education system. I don't know about Finland, but I can assure you that in Australia, New Zealand, the UK, Canada, and the US, we do not understand what an effective teacher education program actually is or what its impact is. And that seems strange given the world that we live in. So if I think about this professional journey that our new candidates, our new pre-service teachers get into, in our place, they're selected, they go through a program. That program has to meet the Australian standards for professional teachers. We actually have to teach as teacher educators to those standards. And then we have to assess our pre-service teachers against those standards before they can graduate and then register. We have registration as a teacher. It takes 2 years from graduation to be registered. The idea is that every teacher should have an impact on the learning lives of students. And as a consequence, initial teacher education programs should contribute to that learning lives of students. Our pathway to effective teaching, if you think about it this way, continuing this journey, is the Australian Professional Standards for Teachers. And I know you do not have a set of standards. We've had some discussions over the last day or so about competencies, about the idea of what an effective teacher is. And Australia has gone down this path of these seven standards that have been implemented, such that now 97% of teachers use the standards in some form in their teaching. Now, that may be for a teacher evaluation, or it may be for professional development, or it may simply be for organising their staffing, curriculum, etc. So, as teacher educators, we also have to demonstrate that our candidates have access to these standards. I think it's, while it doesn't actually relate to selection, in a sense it does. What we're actually doing is saying that the journey from selection to becoming an effective teacher relates to these standards. As a teacher education community, we are accredited against these standards. So considering the context of Australia, it is different. But in many ways, what is happening to us is also happening around the world. And one of the things that the University of Melbourne has done is taken a proactive view in terms of the assessment and selection of our teacher candidates. In attempting to understand how we were going to actually select candidates, the University of Melbourne is a graduate program, and we have approximately 2,500 to 3,000 candidates each year for 1,000 places. And as a consequence of that, our institution said, well, how do we choose? How do we fairly choose? And what you could well imagine, that choice for who got in and who didn't was a little variable, but generally rested with the idea of a grade point average, so GPA. Smarter you were, the higher the chance of getting in. And that was probably truth for all of our 400-some programs in Australia. The idea is that we select on how smart you are, not about dispositions. So the University of Melbourne took the view that a teacher's brain, as we know, is incredibly complex. They have to do so many things. School is complex. Children are complex. We all have different cells that we have to deal with. So if you consider the context of education and you consider the context of teaching teachers to become teachers, for us it did not make sense that we would just simply focus on how smart you are, because we know that those people who are incredibly able, for example, in STEM subjects, maths, science, the physics boffin, often does not get the top job. The person who is smart, maths or science, but has communication skills, that shows initiative, resilience, they're the ones that are being employed. So, again, we took the view that it can't just be about GPA. And when we were looking at an evidence base in terms of what's everybody doing in terms of selection, what we were clear about is that we needed to consider what we're actually trying to predict at the end. To work backwards, a backward design. We know that achievement, previous achievement, accounts for a good 40% of success in education. But being 40% right was not enough. We know that the context in which a person is going to teach accounts for a considerable amount. So what we're left with is the teacher, the pre-service teacher, who they are, and our idea was to start with a pre-service teacher and explore the notion of the teacher as the self. just thinking about what was happening in Australia at the time, University of Melbourne attempted to develop a tool, if you like, for selection prior to a federal government policy that said you must demonstrate who you're selecting, how you're selecting, and what your impact on each of those individual pre-service teachers is, and then eventually what your impact on the learning lives of students is. Our programs, our 400 programs within Australia, are all having to demonstrate our impact. This is something we have not had to do, despite accreditation at a university higher education level. We have never had to demonstrate that we actually have an impact on our teacher candidates and their lives as effective teacher. So what's our role? As you can imagine, as a bunch of researchers, what we decided to do was to get together and have a look at what everybody else was doing, what the research suggests. From an academic perspective, again, verbal skills, quantitative skills, analytic skills account for success at university across the sectors, a good half of it. But as a professional, if you look at the literature across the world, and recently the World Economic Forum described the characteristics of new graduates or employees and what our employers wanted our up-and-coming graduates to be. And it was all the characteristics on the professional side, not on the academic side. And recently the OECD released a report examining 21st century skills and trying to understand how we were actually promoting those skills. I do want to remind them that we're a bit late. We should be thinking 22nd century skills. As you heard this morning, our teachers are now going to be in the profession for a very long time. Those that we are training now are actually going to be the teachers of my grandchildren. So our future is now. We looked across various disciplines, and we all compare to medicine. Look what medicine do. They're exciting. They do all these wonderful things. If you look across industry and selection into accountancy or law, veterinary science, most of the professions do have varying systematic methods of selection and don't seem to struggle the way that we do with the idea of selection. And I think that's one of the things that I want to talk to you about today is these are challenges that we're facing. How do we select? Should we select? If you listen to our new dean, no, we're going to take everybody. Well, is that cost effective? Does that make sense? Is that fair? And I hope we can have a discussion about those questions. So looking at what's happening across the world in terms of selection, you'll see that there are many, many forms. And we don't actually know what method is actually the best and most effective way to select. And if you consider teaching amongst all of these professions, there are so many views of what a teacher is or should be. It's complicated and complex. We expect so many things to be a part of an effective teacher. We expect an effective teacher to do so many things, yet we truly don't understand what an effective teacher is. And it isn't just about academic achievement. We know that. But how do we measure what an effective teacher is and then work back from that and select people who may actually have a fair chance of being an effective teacher. So we did a review of methods. And I'm just summarising it for you today. And you can see the value, the big ticks. What are the things that contribute in terms of effective selection? In a way, understanding what's the impact of the selection procedure on the effectiveness of the profession. Looking across all of the professions that we can find information on. There's very little on education. What we know that prior learning, it does contribute. Again, just think, it's actually about 42%, but think half of the selection procedure relates to prior learning. Kind of makes sense. But it's the other half that we don't understand. Interviews, general, group interviews, one-on-one, 10-minute interviews by a teacher-educator have no relationship to success. Interviews in medicine, whatever. Because we know the bias that occurs in terms of interviews. The validity and reliability of interviews is lacking. Multiple mini-interviews across faculties of medicine are demonstrating strong reliabilities and strong relationship to effectiveness in a program. And I think it makes sense if you think about assessment. Any assessment that you just do once, multiple assessments, multiple times, will give you a stronger reliability. You can see group interviews. I don't know whether you have them here, but in Australia, our principals are allowed to write a letter and say, this student is the best student ever, and they will make the best teacher ever. Please take them into your program. It's about 5% that get into our programs at undergraduate. Guess what? In Australia, they tend to not do very well in the programs. Because generally, the principals are selecting those that they like, that are well-behaved, that do what they're told. And that probably doesn't describe a teacher. Work experience, the idea that somebody is going to write a referee's report for you. If you look down the bottom, where you've got situational judgment items, standardized assessments, non-cognitive assessments, cognitive assessments, and teaching demonstrations all relate to a course-weighted average success. And in some cases, we can demonstrate that those with more than the one tick will contribute to effectiveness in a profession where effectiveness is clearly defined. Medicine is easy. Patient through, successful patient, successful surgery, live or die. They're the kind of things that they look at. So, really, the evidence is scant in education. And from what we know, that there isn't really one method that stands out better than the other in determining whether a person is not only going to be an effective teacher, but impact on the learning lives of students. And you have to keep coming backwards. You have to think about this backward design. What is our contribution to the person that is going to impact on the lives of students? There is very little evidence about our contribution, and I can't say that enough to you. And I think this is part of our issue. So, questions, and I come back to this again. Yesterday, I described our Australian education system as one where we still expect that our teachers are Florence Nightingales. Does that make sense to you? That we teach because we love kids. We teach because we want to save the world. That all teachers were born and made equal. Hard to argue with. Because who decides who gets the teacher that's not so great? Who decides who gets the teacher that's great? However we define them. The same is true of our teacher education programs. So I'm grounding the idea of selection in the idea of effective teaching. And how do we select people to take that journey so that they are incredibly effective? But what that means is that how do we provide a feedback to those people that don't get in? How do we provide equity and diversity so that we are giving everybody a fair and equal chance to get in if we are going to assess them and say, here's the cutoff. You don't get in. You didn't make it. What are the alternative pathways that we're going to use? So these are massive implications for us when we consider. And again, I want you to work backwards and think about us as educators. When we consider that the weight of the world rests in education, look at the Sustainable Development Goals. It's all about education. It's all about providing access and effective education to children everywhere. In war-torn countries, it's about peace and security. So, if you backward design from there, effective teaching, all the way back to we're sitting there selecting our candidates, then this role becomes incredibly important. Your role as a teacher educator is contributing to that mighty weight of saving the world. I know it sounds corny, but I firmly believe that education will and does save the world. And what's our role in that? And are we selecting the right people who can do that? So let me lighten the mood a little bit. I do like to get on my soapbox and talk about the worth and merit of education. I don't believe there is any better profession anywhere. And I don't understand in the rest of the world, not so much in Finland, and I'm learning. Why does it not have the status in the rest of the world that it has here? I don't get it. I really don't. In my family, there's 8 of us. 7 of us are educators, so we're totally biased. Totally. And even when we're not being an educator in a formal sense, we're educating. It's what we do. We live and breathe it. And we love the fact that we can point to Finland and say, well, there is one place in the world where people value teachers. Go to the US. Go to a place like South Georgia in the US and recognize that they're pulling people off the streets to teach, pulling people from heads of factories because they've demonstrated that they can manage people and they're making them principals. I find that offensive. In the US, anybody who has served a term in Afghanistan can go straight into a teaching position. Guaranteed. But what does that say? Again, don't get me started. So in light of this view, there are a group of us who decided that we needed to consider selection not so much as a part of actually, selection. We're not selecting you or you or you. What we're doing is presenting a view of professionalization. Presenting a view is, if I can give you lots of information about you, that we believe is important to become an effective teacher, then we are going to assist you on your professional journey. And hence the teacher capability tool was born. It started as a selection procedure. We had 3,000 candidates and we have to make a decision. Now, I do have to preface this by saying that the University of Melbourne is a high-stakes university. And if you consider that a grade point average to get into the University of Melbourne somewhere between 0 and 100, to get into a Bachelor of Arts degree, you have to be 97.4 or above. To get into medicine, it's 99.5. So the regulations within our university actually restrict us anyway. So I am presenting a view where we have candidates who are amazing. Our Masters of Clinical Teaching candidates are scary. They are bright. So I'm not saying that the University of Melbourne doesn't just select on bright. We have no choice. There is an average on a scale of 1 to 10. Consider anybody below four, cannot enter the university anyway. So, you know, there's a group of people that can't join the university. That is not true of all universities. Most 50% of our universities, people can get in on a zero. And again, that's the biggest question that our government is facing. How smart do you have to be allowed into a university? And our various states have just set different benchmarks. And the benchmark is around 60% on average, around 6 out of 10. Having said that, they have also allowing for alternative pathways into education. So there's the selection procedure, and then there's a selection procedure for other people, which is a way of dealing with inclusion, diversity, and fairness. So TCAT was born, and the idea was to create an assessment where we would consider the cognitive ability, considering GPA is still there, prior learning, cognitive ability, dispositions, psychosocial resources, communication skills, and cultural competency. So TCAT was born, and it was decided to use multiple methods as a selection process. And as you can see from the picture up there, our candidates, very simply, it's an online assessment, come in, and they have to produce a written piece online. There are three questions that they have to ask, which is, why do you want to be a teacher? What do you think an effective teacher is? And tell us your story. Tell us about your background and how it relates to education. The beauty of candidates having to do that is not only do we understand what they think education is all about, why they want to be a teacher, which is important, but we also can understand their written ability. And so the information is coded for their answers and coded for their literacy levels. From there, candidates move to a standardized assessment where we cover cognitive abilities, self and social interaction. Finally, they will utilise some situational judgment items, which relate to those really hard to measure aspects like cultural competency, respect of difference, disabilities, caring for people. So there's three approaches. One, you're just writing. Two, you're doing standardised items. And three, situational judgment items. The assessment is divided into two areas. One is core. Everybody does the one thing. And then if it's high stakes, so scholarship, Teach for Australia, where you really, or residency program, where you've got 8 weeks and then you're going straight out into a school, or you're in a shortened, again, scholarship or an internship of some kind, then there are two other modules that we've devised that people use. And they're really only used for, again, these high-stakes areas where money is concerned, or a short period of training before you're actually in front of children. And for that, we have a structured interview, which is generally done via Zoom or Skype, or face-to-face if we're in the same city, or telephone. The second part of that, then, is a teaching demonstration. And the teaching demonstration, you actually have to either role-play or video yourself in some kind of form of teaching. That's submitted and it's reviewed by a panel. And one of the panel will always be a principal. So teacher educator, researcher, and a principal. So that's what it looks like. It generally takes the core, takes about an hour and a quarter. Biggest complaint we have about the assessment takes too long. And my response is always, well, if you think that assessment is too long, do not be a teacher, because you will not survive. If you aren't prepared to sit for an hour and a quarter, even an hour and a half, to do this, then don't bother being a teacher. So these are the scales that it measures. Again, we use these multiple methods. When you look at these scales, what we've attempted to do is to use an evidence base. And the evidence base is, here's a particular construct. How does that construct relate to the learning lives of students? Either academically or the affective side of students, or engagement, staying at school. And I can tell you that across all of those constructs, the evidence, there is some evidence for some of it. Some evidence is very strong. Consider self-efficacy as a teacher. It relates to the academic achievement of students. Consider optimism versus pessimism. There is no evidence that being a pessimistic teacher will influence the outcomes for a student. But as I put to everybody, do you really want a pessimistic teacher teaching your kids? Probably not. So when people look at TCAT, there is the view that you're just measuring personality. There is no doubt that the big five personalities are there in some form. There is no evidence that the big five personality variables relate to the learning lives of students. Not enough that you'd sit here and say, well, you should actually measure those. On the other hand, if you take some of those variables, introvert versus extrovert, do you really want an introverted, pessimistic teacher teaching your kids? And that's, you know, some of this is intuitive. And we state very strongly that TCAT is not a personality test. What it is doing is providing information for our teacher candidates on those dispositions and constructs that we think are important for a teacher to consider. So, the way we use this information, TCAT is currently being used by 7 institutions and 2 government groups who are selecting for scholarships, or they have a group of people who've graduated and they are relief teachers. So they have a big pool of teachers that they're trying to do some professional development for, and they want to think about how they would support them. So if we're talking about a teacher education provider, and they were using TCAT, what we would do is say, look, the candidates are going to come online, they're going to complete the core tool, then the data on all of these applicants are all going to be rated and ranked and put on a percentile scale. So you can actually look at the profile of every individual candidate against the profile of somebody else. One of the things that most providers ask of us is to tell them who they should select and who they shouldn't. And we say, well, we can't do that. That depends on the nature of your program. We can, given the nature of the data, create cut scores and say, well, here's a natural cut. It's on a percentile scale, so you can see where the data will tell you it's a normal curve where the curve starts to go up and the curve starts to go down. We can do that. But the point is, if we ask our initial teacher education providers to say, what is it you are actually trying to do in your program? How are you going to impact on these people? If you are going to teach in the Northern Territory of Australia, how many people have been to Australia? How many people have been to the Northern Territory? Yes, so you know what I'm talking about. It's way up there. It's remote. It's probably one of the hardest places to teach. And it's one of those places where those of us who are Australian feel a little sad and a little offended by the lack of support that people in our remote and Aboriginal areas are getting. Australia has not treated our Indigenous folks kindly, despite the fact that we've apologised. We still haven't made it right. So the average tenure of a teacher is about 6 months. The average tenure of a principal in schools in those areas is between 9 and 12 months. So the kids in the worst conditions often have no hope, because those teachers who can't get a job often go up there. So our worst communities are getting the worst education. So if you are training teachers to work in that context, then the critical thing is, what are the characteristics that you want? And consequently, what TCAT can tell you is how you can raise or lower the dial. We can tell whether candidates are accepting of difference or not. If you are going to work in the Northern Territory of Australia, you have to be accepting of difference, and you have to have some level of cultural competency, or you will struggle. More importantly, your kids will struggle. So the idea is, as a teacher education institution, what is it you are trying to do? What is your theory of action? What do you believe that your candidates will be like? What do you want them to be like? So you raise and lower the dial on these constructs within, and you choose. You simply now have the data to make those choices. And that's a firm decision that we have made. We can analyse it, we can cut it many ways. All applicants that enter a program that use TCAT get feedback on their profile. We do not have the capacity at this stage to provide feedback to those who do not get into a program. Security. We aren't fully randomised. We are partially randomised. Our situational judgment items are randomised, and 60 to 70% of our constructs are fully randomised. The rest are partially randomised. So until we have full randomisation, we cannot provide information back to anybody who gets in. But that's what we're working on at the moment. So our idea is, if we can provide information back to those who are rejected, then they will understand what education is all about. what it means to be a teacher. This is what it looks like. They have to go through a whole pile of processes to get a password, a link password, and then they have to load some identification. Our own university then has a system where that identification is matched to their enrolment process, which means we can pick up people who are gaming. Our university is quite harsh and worry about security and gaming. There's a part of me that doesn't have a problem with somebody who tries this four times to get in because they really want to be a teacher. And I probably want somebody who's there, who wants to be there, as opposed to somebody whose parents have told them that they'd be a good teacher. Okay. We present the information back to our teacher educators as a cohort, as a full view. So they get a report. They can look at their own areas. We do not provide individual student information back to teacher educators. There is no ethics committee within Australia that will allow us to do that anyway. But if we want our teacher education candidates to use the data to be engaged in this process and think about themselves as a professional from the get-go, and we want them to critically reflect on who they are and who they're going to be as a teacher, if we put barriers in the way, like we're going to give your information back to your teacher educators, the people or your teacher mentors, then we would be just doing an assessment and they wouldn't engage in it. The power struggle would be too great. So what you can see here is we have all of the variables and across the bottom. So they're ranked simply on a percentage scale. And this is 1 year's cohort. This is 2016. What we can do is then compare that to all the other cohorts. TCAT has been going for 4 years in full capacity. 3 years in capacity where our university said we will choose based on GPA and TCAT results. Our dean, previous dean, delighted in telling the world that he refused entry into his teacher education program for 12 PhDs. And you can imagine what that is like for a dean, having to tell a PhD that, sorry, you don't cut it. You're not quite good enough to get into our program. What the university wanted was for TCAT to be strong enough as a tool so that any lawyer could not argue with it if it went to court, which it never would in Australia. But if it did, if you're in the US, it would go to court. You could be sued. So what you can see here is interesting. We have, if you look at vocab down this end. One of the things in policy for Australia is all of our teacher education candidates now have to sit a numeracy and literacy assessment that has been developed by government in the last 6 months of their program, whether they're undergraduate or postgraduate. And what that means is they could actually pass their test, their course, but fail the numeracy and literacy test and they would never be able to teach in school. So one of the things that we decided was to ensure that when our teacher candidates are selected, we would know what their numeracy and literacy levels are. Makes sense to me. If we know that they are struggling with certain levels of vocab, and this was a very, very low year for the University of Melbourne, which is why I like to use it, because they're, this couldn't possibly be our students. I am sorry. Yes, they are. Significantly different to the rest of the database. It means that they are in danger of not passing that numeracy and literacy test at the end of their course. Well, that would be horrible for the University of Melbourne. And so, looking at that, and our argument to the teacher educators is, well, okay, what are you going to do about it? Most of our teacher educators would say, well, it's not our responsibility. My argument is, if you have a teacher candidate for 4 years or 2 years, and you can't impact on their vocabulary, there is something wrong with you. If you were in a school and after 4 years, your children hadn't improved in literacy or numeracy, if you're in the US, you'd be fired. In Australia, we just move you on. So why aren't we the same? The other argument is our teacher candidates get this information. So they must take some responsibility as well. What are they going to do about it when they know that their scores are less than acceptable? The other one at this end is leadership. Fairness and norms, you can see, is quite high. Cultural sensitivity within this group is good. Another one that I want to show you is, and it may not be there, social desirability. So we do a social desirability test. And the idea with the social desirability construct is that we can tell whether they are just telling us what we want to know. So we add these items as a safety net. Because many of the questions that we ask, you could go, oh, I know what they want me to say. Robert Klassen many years ago, about 4 or 5 years ago, said, your test is all self-report, therefore it's not good enough. I remember saying to Robert, but your test is all situational judgment, not good enough. Neither of them are strong enough to say that every single person is, you're going to get a perfect response. This is just the beginning. Our teacher candidates get this kind of response. So they're allowed, they get their graphs, they get some, it's minimal, but it's an explanation of where you are in comparison to somebody else. What we're actually doing is putting them on this professional journey to thinking critically about themselves as a teacher, with the idea that we're saying to them very loudly, very clearly, that you have chosen to become a teacher. You are now a professional. Consider where you are and where you want to be. By providing information to them in relation to other people, they know what their responsibilities are. It doesn't mean that all of them take it seriously. And it doesn't mean, particularly at the University of Melbourne, that every teacher candidate passes and gets through their subject. It doesn't mean that this is foolproof. It is just the first line of defence. What we can also do is provide information back to our teacher educators about the difference between the modes, programs, etc. So here, just to give you an example, we've highlighted some variables and the difference. Invariably for us, our early childhood groups differ. So you can see that one that's circled, conflict resolution. Kind of makes sense. You know, do you really need conflict resolution skills to get a three-year-old to do something? Maybe you do. I had four boys, so trust me, I needed all the conflict resolution skills I could get together. But you'll see some significant differences across the cohorts. This also is the same for different specialisations. So art in particular struggle with this, our arts curriculum. And we can't quite figure out why. But there is support in some areas. Interestingly, we do not yet provide support for our early childhood candidates who are more than 50% are international students. And they will struggle with some aspects of these characteristics. But our program is as yet not providing support for them. It's a challenge. I don't quite understand. We can tell you whatever you want to know. We currently have close to 17,000 candidates in our database. So we can tell you who wants to be a teacher and where they're coming from. Cognitive ability. This is Melbourne. And what you can see is they're actually, despite the verbal, the numerical reasoning is really quite high. Comprehension and vocabulary is sitting around 70%, but they're not actually doing too badly. We can talk about their dispositions. And if you look across these dispositions, what you've got is extroversion, agreeableness, conscientiousness, emotional stability, and openness. Openness is a significant one for teaching. Open to change. Open to feedback. Emotional stability is an interesting one. Across 4 years of looking at this data, our candidates that come into the University of Melbourne worry a lot and are very anxious, and hence they do not as well as some of our undergraduates in emotional stability. The simple explanation is the nature of the University of Melbourne. It's high stakes, it's scary for people. So there's a lot of pressure to achieve. Communication skills, you can see minimum, maximum, mean in the middle. Again, doing quite well. So this was an interesting one, cultural sensitivity. If you look across the board, most people will score on a scale of 1 to 6, between 4 and 6. The variance between 4 and 6 is enormous. If you look at every single dot of for each candidate, you will see enormous differences. And so even though it's acceptable, we don't really understand what cultural sensitivity or acceptance of difference really should be. What's the benchmark? What does it relate to? But you will see significant variance across these groups. Our professor of Indigenous Studies would say to you, there should be no variance. They should all be sixes. How can you have a teacher that at some point is not culturally competent? Again, a challenge that I want you to think about, which I think is different here to perhaps Australia, where we are not bicultural by any means. We are very multicultural, but we have a lagging Indigenous group who ensure that Australia will not reach those heights on international scales as Finland does, because the gap between those that have and those that don't is too big. I wanted to share with you a study. I know that this is where I met Anu, and we did some work in the US. And what we wanted to do was to understand if those people who wanted to be a teacher in Australia was the same as those people who wanted to be a teacher in the US, given the enormous issues around education in the US and, in fact, the UK. But the US is a bit scary. So we have two cohorts. One is an open access university. Takes anybody, undergraduate. Basically, anybody that breathes, you come, you attend, you're in. As opposed to a residency-type program, which was as high stakes as Melbourne. So two different states, and they did TCAT. And again, what we were trying to do is understand the selection period notion and understand if there are any similarities. So I'm going to go straight to the data. See all the variables down there. What you notice straight away is the pattern. What I can tell you is when we first did this analysis, it's just means down the side. I went back to the raw data because I thought this is not right. This cannot possibly be right. So what you've got is the blue is Melbourne. You've got the orange is one state, the residency program, high stakes. And the grey is the open access. There are significant differences along those lines, and there should be. We are dealing with extremely different populations, different groups. But the pattern is the same. And what that tells us is that there's a group of people out there who actually want to be a teacher. And they're a particular type of person. Right, you're wrongly. This is what you would expect. Cognitive ability varies. The grey is the undergraduate open access. Melbourne, we're a little mortified to think that Melbourne's the blue. If you can, those of you who have heard about the University of Melbourne will know it's a bit full of itself, a little elitist, and likes to be number one. And it wasn't. But I do have to say, this was a random sample. And within this group, Melbourne, we don't know who got in and who didn't. To which the people at the University of Melbourne went, okay, we can relax now. Okay, again, this is an interesting one. One of the things that we're able to do with TCAT is look at what candidates are actually saying about effective teaching. If you remember from the beginning, I said our candidates are allowed to write about what they think an effective teacher is. One of the research projects we've been involved in is understanding what people think effective teaching actually is. We've actually used secondary data to look at parents' views of effective teaching in New Zealand. And what we're trying to do is compare to those people who want to be a teacher, what they think an effective teacher is, with the view that that's the beginning of their professional identity. And maybe it's our job to massage that professional identity. So what we did is look at everything that they wrote, and instead of imposing a score on it like we do with TCAT, we did a deep dive. It was really a content analysis of what they were saying. And then across the three institutions, so this time US is blue, Melbourne is the orange, and the undergraduate in the US is the green. And we asked, what are all the things? So when you do the code and you look just across the frequency, these are all the things that came out. So at this end, you've got role model, you've got that they're flexible, that they come in with a set of expectations to improve, they're confident, they're leaders, hardworking. At the other end, you've got things like they're patient, they care for children, they're observant, they love learning, they're kind, they're empathic. They are positive, etc. So we took all of those, and there was enough that we could actually do a factor analysis. And fingers crossed, it actually worked. And four factors were created. The first factor is, actually, let me just go back and say one thing. Despite the differences, there is quite a similar pattern. When you do the analysis and looking at it, the pattern is the same. Despite the one university, the blue one, having some different views, and the green one having very specific views around things like responsibility, hardworking, kind, empathy, etc. So when we did the factor analysis, what we were able to demonstrate is that attitude and relationship is the key factor. It's the one that all our candidates are coming in and saying that is important for an effective teacher. If you look at the green, this is the undergraduate group, and the common phrase was that a teacher should be kind, patient, and should mother the children. They should love the children. While the University of Melbourne was not so loving, That's kind of the same thing was coming out. The view is that this is about, it's all about how you communicate and how you create a friendship with the children. The second one is preparedness. Everybody agrees. You can see they're very similar. You have to know stuff and you have to be able to do stuff. It's as simple as that. And I don't think anybody would argue with that one. The next one is the dispositions. Generally, the disposition that most candidates thought about, whether it was in Melbourne or the other two, but definitely in the green one, is that you must be moral. You must be an upstanding, moral, trustworthy person. And then fun-loving and happy at the same time. So dispositions were important. This one, the lowest one, again, very significantly different from the others, is the idea of thinking evaluatively. And this is the notion that as an effective teacher, you will understand that your job is to enhance, to improve, to provide feedback, to assess, and to have an impact on children in terms of their achievement and their school lives and their learning. Now, it's a simple argument here. Our job as teacher educators is to flip that graph. If we know what they're coming in with, then we know what we need to change. If we don't, then we struggle. The other thing that we did was to look at whether TCAT was actually predicting success in the program. And at this stage, that's all we can do. We have some small pieces of evidence that demonstrates that those who are more successful on TCAT or have higher scores on TCAT have a higher probability of getting a job. But the evidence is scant, and that just could be the nature of those candidates. But we are able to demonstrate, as a consequence of all of the candidates, that prior learning still predicts success in a program, whether it's practical experience or not. But it doesn't predict it alone as well as TCAT does alone. So there's a higher probability, or the correlation between your TCAT scores and your course-weighted average is incredibly high. But what we're arguing is that you should never just use one. Because if you put those two things together, how powerful is that? And so we did a structural model looking at TCAT to demonstrate course-weighted average. The ones in blue are incredibly significant. Those ethics and resilience are significant, but resting around zero. So not really changing that much. That just explains those characteristics that seem to be more important. So self-regulation, conscientiousness, so that's resilience, which we all expected would be high, was not so much. I want to talk a little bit about motivation for teaching, because this is the other area that we're trying to relate the idea of a person's motivation to come into a program as a selection process, and how does that relate to their idea of professional identity. And what you can see is the reasons that for teaching from this group is some people just really didn't say passion for helping, experience and impact, and helping community. What you see in the middle is this, again, this passion for doing good. And I don't want to knock it. I don't want to say that's a bad thing. But it is a concern that that's really what our teachers, pre-service teachers, that's what they think teaching is about. So what we did is the same thing. We looked at what they were saying, and across the two states and Melbourne, and you know, it was a given what we already knew. We want to make a difference to the world. We already have the knowledge and skill. We understand the significance of education as a human right. We love working with children. We've had great role models. It's convenient, which you can see is up there, a little higher than it probably should be. And generally this is people who, young mums or people who'd been in teacher's aides type positions before, and it was just a natural progression for them, but they love the holidays. You would be surprised the number of people who wrote in their applications that teachers have great holidays and that would be really good. And I thought, why would you do that? Why would you say that? But they did. Family of teachers, they know it. They love to learn themselves. They love seeing children learn, and it's an important career. So what you can actually see is there's intrinsic and extrinsic motivation for coming into teaching. What we're trying to do is provide all of this information back to our teacher educators so that they actually know who they're teaching, with the hope that they'll also understand the impact of their program. But also getting our teacher educators to consider what they believe effective teaching is. So if we consider what's a sophisticated selection process, this would be our view. It uses multiple methods, but most importantly, it adds value to the idea of professionalisation, and it allows us to demonstrate impact. Transparency is an interesting one. Remember, our government has said that it needs to be a sophisticated and transparent approach to selection. Because why make it a secret? Why is coming into teaching and the selection process so closely guarded? Why wouldn't we open it up and say, this is what you've got to do to be a teacher? And that's what our government is doing. So the idea is simply, let's ensure that those hurdles, the things that you've got to do, are very clear. So when you are coming in, when you are selecting in as a teacher, you are becoming a professional straight away and you know what the game is all about. Knowledge translation here is absolutely and utterly key. Our argument from a research perspective, if you look at the view of research, it must be translatable. It must be creating knowledge for somebody, otherwise it's just assessment for assessment's sake. And we don't do that in education. I would love to tell you that all of our teacher educators think that this is the best thing since sliced bread. But if I go back to my squirrel diagram, they are still saying, what are you doing? Why? Our teacher educators at the University of Melbourne, in their heart of hearts, would love to sit down and look and touch the person because they firmly believe that they know who is going to be a good teacher and who isn't. And I sigh. We have a group of champions at the University of Melbourne who go, oh, we need to do this. And they love it when we give them the information back. Most of them would like to have individual candidates' information. And to be fair, I think they would like it because they would say they would know how to help the actual individual candidates. Our candidates are encouraged to share their TCAT results if they're having a problem. But can you imagine the power struggle between a teacher educator or a mentor teacher and a pre-service teacher when you know everything about them, when you're able to say, I told you you weren't confident enough. I told you that you weren't accepting of difference. That will never happen. So there are other challenges. Cost, skepticism, the paradigm wars, and a view that, which is the crucial one, why would we stop anybody wanting to be a teacher? And the argument is a simple one. If our assessment systems all the way through were solid and robust, and we weren't actually pushing everybody through to pass, so that we were losing people along the way who weren't making the grade, then maybe we could accept everybody. I don't believe that the Australian, the American, the New Zealand, the Canadian, the Western world has a system that is like that. Finland has a very different system, and some of your neighbours have a system that is a little more rigorous. But without rigorous assessment along the way, we would let everybody in and they would all pass. Nobody fails practicum. I don't think they've practical experience. I'm not sure they fail practicum experience here either. Nope. Because we push them through. So one of the things to consider is if we do want to accept everybody in, what we need to do is to think about who they are. I just want to finish with an argument that we have been pushing for a long time. Assessment of children, assessment of anybody, psychology, etc., has a series of standards that must be achieved to assess. Ethics, if you like. We would argue that there is a set of international standards that suggest any assessment, any evaluation of anybody should be useful. It should ensure no harm, feasible to do, accurate, which means reliable and valid. It should be accountable. And it should also be reproducible at any point. And so what we've been trying to do is to come up with a framework for selection process, considering not so much the context or even what an effective teacher is, but if you are going to come up with a selection process, what are the guidelines for doing that? What are the standards, ethical, moral, and appropriateness in terms of standards to select? And with this, we would argue that if you're able to do and achieve these particular aspects, then making the judgment and adding value might be worthwhile. Again, we firmly believe that education changes the world. Thank you.
And now I think the coffee is waiting for us, but perhaps we will still have time for some questions or comments. Would like to start?
Thank you very much for your very wonderful talk. It's really nice to hear your thoughts about selection. I was wondering about the gender differences. I wonder if you have the same situation that we do here, that we have so many more women.
Across the US, in the two states, and certainly in Australia, we're sitting at a 70-30 at the moment. It used to be 60-40, but our database is around 70-30. Yeah.
In the selection process. So
I think the this one, from what we know at the moment, looking at our database, we don't see gender difference, even though there is obviously incredible sample size difference. Our country is a little harsher in the view of why it's women as opposed to men, and that's it's a more convenient, easier profession for women because they get the school holidays. And so that it is harsh, and it tells us that people don't understand. I don't believe that any of the assessments that are used in terms of social skills have a bias towards gender. They shouldn't. They're all standardised to ensure that there is no ethnic or gender bias. But it's certainly a question that we face frequently. So for ours, it's all prior to selection, to enrolment. So even our internationals now will do, so they apply to a, we have a standard portal that all university students at, in Australia can apply to. And or you can go through the specific university and it's linked up. So once they've done that and they get a password, then they will do, so they apply, then they get an automatic link to TCAT, or our candidates do. And there is a waiting period. So at this stage, there are 2 points where candidates, we batch them in. So for us, around September through to November is an incredible period of applications coming in. And a candidate can put an application in any time and then do TCAT. The selection procedure will be at 2 points. And last year we did 3. So it was October, November, and January. And so they don't get in at all unless they sit TCAT. It's a requirement. And once, and then their results have to be processed. And so if they are below the cut scores on each of those scales on TCAT as set by the department, they do not get an entry into a program. Yes. So in terms of the cognitive ability, so the at that particular year, the whole cohort were lined up, and if you looked at it, it's 6 was the cutoff. And so, if again, it's a percentile scale. So the institution decides where the cut is, and what they would do is we're not taking anybody who's below, let's say, 4 on anything. Anybody who's above 7 on everything, automatically in. And so then what happens is the ones in the middle, the teacher educators, will look at the profiles of, there's no identification, so they just have a number. They look at those and they go, well, look at this person. So you're going to get people who are like this, high on some things, low on another. So what is it you're prepared to accept? What is it you want in your program? And so it's always the ones in the middle that the teacher educators spend hours discussing. And they have access to the scripts if they want. And that's how it works. So it used to take days with 3,000 candidates, days and days, because they would look at their application, bring them in, then sit down and then do the selection. And University of Melbourne was always last because they had so many. And now it takes a day. But the selection team from each particular cohort will look at the data, and then there's red flags. You know, there's, again, those people who are down here, they're instantly out. But we don't make that decision. The teacher educators do. Does that help? Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Janet. And we can continue with the discussions during the coffee break and also in the evening.
Okay, thank you.
Now, two practical things. You can have your teacher, if you don't have any, about there. Is it right, Father? Okay, you will be there with the teachers. And then we will have coffee. And after the coffee, we would like to have a photo of us all. And we will take it here by those stairs. Mm-hmm. So have a cup of coffee and relax, and then we will have a photo.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's continue our program together. And let me remind you that that this event is being live streamed through net, and therefore we were asked to use the microphone when asking the questions and answering the questions. Nyt aloitettaisiin, eikö?
Joo.
Aloitellaan. Okay, Anna-Maja and me, we are going to talk you a little bit about teacher competence model. And as Anu already told you, this has been one of the major goals in the DOORS project, to design a model that would put together the key qualities of good teaching. And what I want to say here is, Janet was talking about the journey, so I want to use the same concept to describe our model building process. It is a journey. And we have started in August or September, and this is where we are now. So I'm going to give you, with Anna-Maja, an overview of the situation at the moment. And I think this is going to be a journey, and there is going to be some model refinement in the future. Okay. You may have heard the saying, teachers who know more teach better. And research tells us that this is, in fact, accurate. Because although there are certainly different views of what it means to know more or teach better, and perhaps one of the most influential frameworks for teacher knowledge has been presented by Lee Shulman, who has introduced the concept of knowledge base of teaching. And he argues that it is really important for teachers to have a strong content knowledge. And teachers also should know the pedagogical knowledge. They should have a strong pedagogical knowledge, so they should know how to teach specific subjects. And the teachers also should know the learners, their characteristics, and the curriculum. And in the DOORS project, we do not argue or question the importance of knowledge. But rather, I think what we are trying to say is that teaching is a really very complex activity, just like we heard before. And therefore, any simple or straightforward idea of teaching is likely to fail to capture this complexity. So I guess our question then is, what are the critical or the most important key qualities of a good teacher? And in the DOORS project, I think we are thinking that this is really important information to be able to select students for teacher training and to be able to design teacher training programs and to be able to organize in-service training. But to understand the full picture of teachers' critical skills, I think we need to move beyond the teacher knowledge literature. and look at the much broader research evidence of effective teaching. And this is, in fact, what we've done in the DOORS project. We have searched and examined the scientific base of teaching and trying to define what are the qualities that define a good teacher. A teacher who would be able to provide learning gains in students and promote the growth of future citizens. I want to say, however, that I suppose it is self-evident that effective teaching is not conducted with one specific set of skills or one specific way of teaching. If you take two teachers who are very skillful, they are not likely to have exactly the same profile and of skills and abilities to conduct classroom instruction. So when we have gone through the research literature, we have learned that although there are not the exact prototype of a good teacher, there are certain characteristics or certain skills or abilities that seem to be typical to good teachers. Trying to create this sort of model of a good teacher or good teaching is, of course, it's very difficult. And many researchers have tried to do that before us. And especially there are very insightful listings of key qualities of our teaching. And these lists are really valuable when we are thinking about organizing in-service training, for instance. But however, we would like to say that perhaps Fred Gordagen's wise comment is accurate. He's saying that any attempt to describe the essential qualities of a good teacher should take into account the various levels which are involved that fundamentally differ from each other. So what this means is that there are different perspectives which are useful when we are analyzing efficient teachers. And each of these perspectives gives us a little bit different answer to the question of what is effective teaching. And when one goes through the literature that concerns quality of teaching, one often comes across the concept of teacher competence. And this is a quite typical definition of teacher competence. It is defined as a combination of knowledge and skills and abilities, even values, which enable the teacher to act professionally and competently in situations involving student learning and teaching. And in this particular definition, teacher competencies are resources to effective teaching. If you understand what I mean, it means that they are kind of underlying characteristics that become manifested when teacher encounters, for instance, challenging situations at work. And some of these competencies are traits or dispositions which are relatively stable across time, so they are resistant to change. They can be like personality variables, for instance, and some other competencies are more prone to change. For instance, certain attitudes can change across time, and these competencies are more they are better targets for teacher education because of their nature as more malleable and changeable characteristics. This definition is quite a typical way of describing teacher competencies, but in the DOORS project we have tried to find a definition that would give us a chance to define it in a more nuanced and more detailed manner, and to provide such a more elaborate interpretation of teacher quality. And we have get to know the work of Sigrid Blömeke. She has presented a model of teacher competencies that we have found really very inspirational in many ways. And as you can see here in the figure, in the right-hand side, Blömeke notes that one can focus on the real-life behaviors of teachers that can be observed in authentic contexts of teaching. And this means that the competencies are manifested in the real-life, everyday action of teachers' work. And it becomes manifested through pedagogical choices or quality of interaction between students and teachers and parents and colleagues. Another level in this model, you can see in the left-hand side, they are the underlying competencies that I was talking earlier. And Blömeke calls these dispositions. They can be cognitive or affective, motivational dispositions. And she defines them as kind of latent variables or latent factors that are resources to effective teaching. And they are also kind of generic, so that they are also useful to any person when they interact also outside of classroom. And the third level is the mediating processes in the middle of this figure. There are mediating processes of perception, interpretation, and decision-making that link the dispositions to the real-life behavior of teachers in the everyday work of teaching. So basically, Blömeke views competencies as a continuum, as you can see here in the figure, so that there are different perspectives that complement each other. And this figure has been really an inspiration to us because we think it's really valuable to be able to look at teaching from different perspectives and to identify different levels when we are trying to define the teacher quality. And this is the model as it looks like at the moment. As you can see, we have adapted Blömeke's model to produce perhaps a more elaborated framework of different aspects of teacher quality. And we feel that this acknowledges more fully the multifaceted nature of teachers' skills and abilities. When building this model, we chose to avoid fragmentation in the long lists of different, sometimes narrow, competencies or aspects of teacher quality. We chose to focus on a limited number of aspects, which together make up the teacher's expertise. And unlike the Blömeke's model, this model is a process model, which means that teachers' competencies and practices contribute to gains in student achievement and also well-being. And very important assumption in the model is that while teachers, of course, influence their students, the students also influence the teachers in a reciprocal manner. We are going to talk you more a little bit more about this model. Anna-Maja will give you examples of the different levels of the model. But before that, I just want to say that just as we heard before, teacher quality cannot be isolated from the context in which it exists. And this figure that you can see here, this is drawn from an article that we have published with Robert Klassen as the lead author. And it shows that what teachers know and what they should be able to do is always embedded in the cultural, educational environment and the policy of the culture, policy cultures of the country. And the work that we have done to conceptualize the teacher quality, of course, concerns primarily Finnish teacher education and Finnish teachers. Although we think, I suppose, that many of those aspects are universally shared. I think what is characteristic to Finnish teacher education and educational system is that there is a strong Nordic tradition of Bildung pedagogy, which values and aims to foster self-development and the cultivation of good life. And these are considered the basic human rights for everybody. And to this end, Finnish teachers have a very strong autonomy to organize the teaching. And now I suppose Anna-Maja will tell you more about the different aspects of the model in more detail.
Right. I guess you can hear me. We thought about that we could go through some of the sort of the more detailed, the boxes of the big model, because when we were doing it, it was more like bottom-up. We went through the literature, and there were tons of concepts, and it was hard negotiation to sort of find out the concepts that would really capture everything that is underneath. And that is some where we still have to do some work, I'm sure, to sort of find out the concepts that are relevant and sort of give right away the underlying concepts also. So, for instance, this one, the observable professional practices, that was on the right side of the figure. This is one example of those professional practices that here refer to carrying out and performing instruction and management in the classroom level. So if you remember, there were also the organizational level where you would be working with your colleagues or you would be working with parents and other organizations or even at the societal level. But this figure focuses on the observable practices in the classroom level. And there are many different classifications of what are the key professional practices. Now we are not so much talking about the competencies, but what we can observe when we go to a classroom and we can look at the teacher-student interaction, for instance. And one example of observing teachers' practices in a classroom is the Teaching Through Interactions framework by Bridget Hammer and Robert Pianta. And this model suggests that teacher effectiveness is a function of the teacher's behavior and interaction with the students and the ways of implementing curricula, making those pedagogical choices. And the TTI model, as it's called, organizes teacher-student interaction into three broad domains: emotional support, instructional quality, and classroom management. And we feel that's it's one way to look at the action, the sort of what happens in the everyday interaction between students and teachers. We know that it's definitely dependent and influenced by the underlying competencies, the latent competencies that the teacher brings to the situation, but also the characteristics of the children, the students, and the context. So having that kind of emotional sensitivity, interaction, and problem-solving skills, and ability to provide productive feedback, that is one of the skills that will help a teacher in these interactional situations in the classroom. What about the situation-specific processing? That was in the middle of the model. And that is maybe the sort of the hardest part of the model to sort of figure out, like, how do we see what's happening in the teacher's head? Because these are decisions at the spur of the moment. They are very fast. There are situations that come, and you have to process the information and make choices. And the literature says that teachers differ in how they focus their attention, especially teachers who have been long in practice. They have a sort of more expertise in sort of spreading the attention and focusing on the critical aspects of visual information, for instance, or auditive information. The more skilled or effective teachers process information faster. They can distribute their attention more evenly in the classroom than the novice teachers. They are more perceptive to very subtle, for instance, auditive cues in interaction, the ways that children present some comments, and they can sort of take on and follow that lead and give space to dialogue. And when attending the classroom events, teachers try to make sense of what they see. So it's the interpretation level that is really critical. And that to do that in a sort of an efficient way, you have to use your professional and practical knowledge. So sometimes it has been called professional vision. It's not only vision in the sort of the only visual sense, but vision of what is important now. How do I proceed in my classroom? So very complex decision making and cognitive processing. Then we go back to the left side of the model, the cognitive and academic underlying competencies or disposition. Plumica calls them dispositions, and I think that she wants to stress that they are something that are not always easy to change. There might be some innate characteristics in our cognitive processing, but we know that effective teaching necessarily requires these cognitive skills. Some of them are definitely changeable across time and in training. They are teachable and learnable. Teaching occurs in sort of constantly changing environments, so and not everything is under the control of the teacher. New information and events appear all the time. So effective information processing and problem solving are the key cognitive skills in teachers' work. Metacognitive knowledge and regulation, critical thinking, creativity, argumentation, and reasoning. These are some of the sort of the skills that are underlying the cognitive skills category. Lee Shulman is one of the persons who's been talking a lot about content knowledge, and I had the humbling and exciting experience to show our model to Lee Shulman some weeks ago, and it was interesting to hear how he emphasized context and not just sort of pedagogical knowledge isolated, but in the context of classroom and all the skills that are needed to sort of capitalize on that knowledge. expert teachers, here too, they have some advantages. They usually have a set of schemata which they can rely on. They have instructional and management routines that minimize their cognitive overload. So they have skills that help them to deal with this information that is taking place in a classroom full of students. So critical thinking and reasoning skills are definitely important. Teachers need to make good choices or at least distinguish between positive and negative alternatives. And being able to reflect upon one's thinking, have metacognitive knowledge and regulation is we think that it's one of the key competencies in teachers' profession. What about the affective or emotional underlying competencies? This non-cognitive factor, these social skills, personal skills, and professional ethics and beliefs, we feel that it's highly important. We know that this has been, in previous selections, one of the perhaps stressed areas. In terms of social skills, effective teachers are known to be high on teamwork, collaboration skills, listening, turn-taking, conflict management, negotiation. They are also good at regulating and expressing emotions, and they have the ability to sort of navigate in complex intercultural environments. And what we heard just earlier is that this kind of awareness of diversity, of different cultures and lifestyles, and these attitudes, which are sort of interculturally sensitive, are something that we need to have in our selection procedures. We have to sort of pay attention to these. Effective teachers also have personal skills. This is a word that we struggled with. Like, how do we call this area where there's motivation, commitment, perseverance, coping and resilience? And we came up with this term, at least at this point. So the teachers need to have some initial motivation to teach, but also persevere in teaching profession. And they have to value their work, and they have to sort of maintain this kind of belief in their own ability, self-efficacy, to successfully accomplish the difficult, complex tasks. Also, of course, to be able to work hard and to sort of pursue long-term goals. I think some of these are really hard to measure at the selection phase. So they are sort of have to be sort of budding there. These dispositions are necessary. The teachers, we want to have teachers who do not give up on students, who try to improve themselves and their teaching and their sort of interactional skills. So we want our future students to have this kind of passion for continued education for themselves and for their students, so that they are willing to refine their teaching skills and engage in reflection. And that's what we also have to teach in our programs. The thing about this adaptive coping, we felt that that's also important to be in the model, because teachers' responsibilities often can lead to burnout or work overload. So having those strategies to sort of prevent this kind of a stressful situation to lead to unpleasant feelings or anxiety or depression, these kind of strategies are necessary, at least to develop in your career. And the ethical dimension, which is there in the bottom, that has come up also in our Finnish data when we asked our teachers, like, what is something that they want to have in a teacher competence model, this kind of professionalism where the ethical questions are thought about and they are discussed and negotiated. Teacher beliefs that concern students, they are also require some ethical considerations. Effective teachers have mind frames that support student achievement, but also are equal and take into account students' differences. And finally, we get to the sort of conclusion.
Okay, as we all know, the DOORS project aims to improve student selection. So I suppose the question then becomes, why bother? Why do all this work in order to improve student selection? And how does this model improve student selections? The basic idea or starting point has been the idea that once we understand the complexity and the different levels of teaching, we might be able to identify those aspects of teaching that we can, in fact, teach during the teacher education programs. What are those aspects of teaching that we can foster and promote in teacher education? And what are those characteristics or dispositions that we cannot, which are not our main goals in the teacher education? And shouldn't we assess those critical skills in the admission processes if we can identify those factors that should be there, but we cannot really improve them so much, so easily during the teacher education? And I think this has been the starting point for the building of this model, and I think what we have started to see that we can, in fact, identify some characteristics that relate to social skills and certain interactional qualities that are really important in teachers' work. And these and also other non-cognitive factors And cognitive factors really should be the targets of evaluation in student admission processes. And this, oops, wow. What happened? Oh, this is our final slide. I don't know. And I suppose what we're trying to do is that we provide a model that gives us a different perspectives in teacher quality. And I think we think that this can serve as a starting point and maybe the basis for future development. And what is important in our model is that there is a really complex interplay between the skills and knowledge and abilities. And we start to see that these abilities manifest themselves differently when we look at the everyday practice of teaching, or if we look at the underlying competencies that form the basis of the, or which are the resources to effective teaching, or if we look at the complex situated mental processes of teachers when they are in fact in the classroom, in their real work environments. So I suppose we think that this model is important for our future work in this DORS project, and the combination of all these approaches are needed if we want to get a good insight into the nature of teaching quality. Okay, I think that was all we wanted to say today. Thank you. Any questions or comments? Yes. We are eager to hear your thoughts and ideas. This is something that we have together worked with the whole group during these months since the September. But are there any additional comments here now?
Yes,
I think it's needed for the live streaming. Yeah.
There are a couple of things. I love it. Thank you very much. One of the things that we've been doing, as you know, is exactly the same thing, trying to work backwards. And the thing that's exciting about what you've done is in the middle, the situational specific processing skills. So given the systematic review that we did, we could show you our model, and it would be almost word for word to those things on that side.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's really exciting. And then similarly, the observable practices that we see and then the outcomes. But what we have not done is that bit in the middle, which I think is the missing factor. So I'm really, one of the things I'm interested in, I guess there's two things. The interpretation, perception, decision making, we've coined that as evaluative thinking, as you saw on that scale. Yeah. And I wondered if you had a comment about, if you put all those things together, is that critical thinking? Is it that interaction process? So that was number one. And just number two, the question that we get asked all the time about knowledge, particularly subject matter knowledge. John Hattie's meta-analysis demonstrates that there is no relationship between subject matter and student achievement. And I wondered if you had the best answer for that. So two questions. How do you define the middle as a whole? And what do you say to people when they say, but isn't there no relationship subject matter knowledge and student achievement in terms of the meta-analysis?
Maybe if I take the last question. Okay, you take the first one. I suppose we've our approach has been a combination of looking at the theoretical base as such, and then those research findings that find the link between certain interesting concepts and the student outcomes. And for instance, Lömeke herself has studied the relationship between content knowledge in math and what in fact happens in the classroom when students and teachers interact. And there seems to be a link, so that those teachers who are more knowledgeable are more clever and more skillful in understanding what is going on in students' mind and why they do not understand specific mathematical problem. So even though that sort of research design does not answer the question if there is learning in the end of the process, but it gives you understanding how the content knowledge helps the teacher when he or she interacts with the students in the classrooms. So why we think that content knowledge is really important.
I think I would tend to agree that there's not really good data on that connection, but it's more like intuitive and anecdotal, which also people who are working mathematics, they would say that unless the teacher, him or herself, understands the concept fully, he or she will not be able to sort of convey that understanding. So content knowledge in the sense of conceptual knowledge, not just sort of like more knowledge on things, but to understanding. And that's where we should push our students to sort of challenge them with the hard topics or the why questions. And then they would be more maybe ready to seize the opportunity for dialogue. Because when there are difficult questions from the audience, the students say, or they produce a misunderstanding or any idea that would be interesting, the teacher would have to be so sure about him or herself that she would or he would not be afraid to sort of pursue that and go to a dialogue, not knowing where it leads. But that's, I think, that content knowledge comes into play, that you would have to have this kind of understanding yourself or to be challenged in your training. And the one in the middle, I think that we are not quite sure what Lömeke means with that, whether it's this kind of the model that is in social competence literature, the SIP, social information processing, which is sort of like microseconds. It's really, really fast. That when somebody comes to you and asks you something, you immediately you make some perceptions, you scan the situation, you listen to the voice, listen to the words being said, and you make an interpretation based on your memories and expectations of the relation between a person. So it might be these micro events, or it might be also this kind of maybe a correct or faulty decision making, because I think that's where the teachers could improve, reflect on it, like, why did you do this? if we have simulated or recall videotapes, having teachers to, we thought about once about this kind of application where we would videotape our students in our practicum and then show these videotapes of the challenging situation and ask them to go back and think, like, why, what happened? Like, did you notice this? Or why did you ask this question? It's hard to go back. And I think it's something that's internal, and maybe the good, efficient teachers learn to sort of use this reflection intuitively, but to do it deliberately is, I think, difficult. So maybe it's kind of a black box, but I think that in training we could sort of open it up, that this is something that you do in any challenging situation. If it's a routine, you don't have to maybe go into this. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I might just add that there is lines of research that are distinct, but which help us understand those different circles in the figure. There is literature on perception and noticing in the classroom.
where the teacher focuses her attention. There is eye tracking research and that sort of stuff, which helps us to understand where is the teacher's attention and where she thinks that her attention is not needed. And then there is this another line of research which talks about professional vision, how you, at the moment, in the moment of instruction, perceive things and how you link the events that you see to the pedagogical content knowledge and the practical knowledge at that moment, and how you behave and what kind of decision you make on the basis of this process of perception and interpretation. So if you combine these different lines of research, then you start to see that there is, in fact, some understanding of what goes on in the mental worlds of teachers when they are in the classroom.
And we could use more sort of insightful designs. For instance, we've been, some of us in our department have been using eye-tracking devices and at the same time observing the classrooms with videotapes. So that kind of technique might give you some ideas, especially the teachers who have been observed and they've been showing their vision through those scans. They are quite excited. Like, okay, this is what I'm doing. I'm ignoring all these guys here. Any other questions?
Okay.
Thank you.
That you still sit here. Yeah, it has been a long day, but I have to say that I'm so happy to be here. I want to thank Anu and Mirva and our Jyväskylä colleagues that you set up this very, very interesting seminar dealing with selection and teacher education. And I especially appreciate it that it's here in Jyväskylä, because that was the first teacher education institution in Finland, which was established here 1863 by Uno Sugneus. And I was very happy to see that you have the year there that the birth of this institution, multidisciplinary University of Jyväskylä, comes back to the teacher education institution, which is very unique, and it shows us that it makes a difference, or it's important. The teacher education is important also as a sort of target of very high level research, which has not been the case in previous years, because there seems to be a very, very sort of strict line between the basic research and research which is more applicable, the soft and hard sciences, and we used to be in the very soft side. But now we are very happy to have this kind of very strong research-based way to deal with. Actually, we will model our dear colleagues from Jyväskylä that we try to do some co-teaching, which is very much along to our guidelines in our newest curriculum, 2016-14, that we want to try to share our ideas about the sub-project number 3 in OVET indoors. Could you please bring that? Yeah. And that means that we are now dealing with, which goes to those, yeah. We are dealing with the issue that we know that, for example, last year, 2017, in Turku, there were almost 1,400 applicants who wanted to become teachers. And we see year after year that this profession is very, very popular among really high achieving students in Finland. And like we have learned from Janet and from our other colleagues, it's unfortunately not the case in other countries, not even in our neighboring countries like Sweden or Denmark. And that means that our teachers are highly valued. There is a trust in Finnish society in teaching what they are doing. And that means that we have a very interesting task, that we really do the job so good that this kind of trust and the trust is still there in future. And so in this sub-project number 3, we actually do backward thinking, like Janet was calling. We try to deal with the data which has been collected for years about our applicants. We do have different kinds of data, your idea about multiple data that we make use in this sub-project about multiple data. Could you please show the research questions? For example, with our national matriculation examination, entrance examination data, and then there is different kinds of feedback collected, for example, in bachelor level and at the end of the study program, and even after 2 years when they have been already employed. And now our idea is to look what kind of students we got, how did they success in their study program, and how did they find the study program, and what kind of feedback did they give during the study. And so these questions, how are these different kinds of data collected from the beginning and during the study program is sort of related to the success and employability and also experiences. That's the first question. And then how is our so-called aptitude test or suitability test, which has been done in different ways in different institutions, how is this test, sort of how does it predict the success or study success and also the employability after graduation? But now I give the word to my colleague Marco, please. I think you have to stay here, perhaps. Easy. I try to do my best. Please.
Yes, and currently we are working about data and collecting the data in different sources. And basically we choose two cohorts in our study based on student who accepted in 2010 and 2013. And one of the reasons why we select these groups was that during that time in universities, they started to collect different kind of course feedback, including when they degree a bachelor phase, and we have opportunity to use that kind of feedback and maybe combine our data sets, and that was the one reason which we choose these cohorts, and we are focusing in Turku, Rauma, and Jyväskylä. It's a kind of pilot design, and we are using different kind of data sets, like Mirjamaya said, starting in selection phase, ending in when teacher are graduation and are employed. And there are, in Finland, there are different kind of surveys when the teacher are graduated. After the graduation, they are asked about not only teacher, also other who are graduating, but also teachers, when they graduate, they are asking about, for example, needed competence in associated their occupation, and also it's kind of draw a picture how the education's response to needed skills and competence in the field. And those surveys, they are asked 1 year after the graduation, and another one is 5 years after the graduation, and that's one which we are using.
And actually, one thing which I think it's very, very important and actually quite unique in Finland, that we are sort of, we can still reach the statistical, the sort of personal data that we can follow up
yeah.
on individual level, which I think it's great, and it would
yeah.
be wonderful when we combine with the vascular and also our other institutions.
That yeah, make definitely. Yeah.
Don't
be scared. I know it's evening coming, but in shortly, there are different phases and research cycles, and basically, our main goal is to look for the predictability starting in teacher candidate selection phase and ending the phase of graduated and employed teachers. And we have kind of shared this in different research cycles, starting in Turku and Rauma case and ending at Jyväskylä case. And then we also hope that we have opportunity to, during this process, develop new model and also think about the measurements during this process, because when we think about the change, what's happened now, we draw a picture about these years, but when the change is happened, we also need kind of new measurements which are associated to this model which Riitta-Leena and Satu just presented us. Yes. And the purpose of this follow-up data and evaluation model is to give kind of preliminary results based on guidelines to this selection process for the teacher candidates. And there's also kind of future directions, because this is ongoing process and it's not getting ready during this time, but we have still many open questions, and for that reason we also have to look for the existing data sources and also think about the new data sources and also kind of measurements to support kind of this evaluation model in for the Finnish teacher education. And then there are these questions, for example, these different data sets in different universities, because there are some difference. For example, these graduated teachers and employability, is it collected in the same way? And then we have also talked about kind of new measurements during the education. What is the most relevant thing to measure during the teacher education, and kind of identifying these critical measurements during this process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we are done. Please. Questions, comments.
Yeah.
Actually, we forgot to say that now we, of course, not of course, but in our case, we concentrate on classroom teacher
yeah.
education. But of course, in future, it would be very interesting to broaden up our sort of, that the sample could be also subject teachers. Because Finland is a very nice, I mean, in that sense, it's an interesting society, just for Janet, because I think all of us know that there's a lot of really register data and feedback collected which is actually never really analyzed and made use of for development of curricula or selection. And I think that would be very nice if we hope that we got some funding for future also, yeah, that we can really, really set up a systematic way of collecting and really make use of that data which has been collected for years already. I think we are now done. Thank you. We can carry on our discussions there later on.
Thank you, Mirja-Maija and Marko. And in this point, I would like to...